This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. Pete Zimmerman's the producer, and Mondays we start with Elise Glink. Elise, if we take the 980 that we lost on Friday and add the 240 we're down today, since Thursday it's a 1,200-point downward swing for the Dow, isn't it?
It is. It's not the kind of math I like to do, and I know you don't like to do it either, but there's certainly a sell-off in the market, and a lot of people are concerned that we're not done yet with it.
What do you mean by that?
Well, there's a lot of concern that China is going into stagflation, that this war between Ukraine and Russia isn't going anywhere sooner, might be later or for not for a long time. And so if that doesn't go away and Ukraine and Russia both can't do the kind of planting they're supposed to do with commodities, we're going to see commodity prices keep going up. And inflation, which has just been the, the millstone around everybody's neck, there's some concern that the Fed might actually do not just a half a point rate rise, but a three-quarter of a point rate rise. And that got the specter of that got raised over the weekend. And although some of the Fed governors poo-pooed it, the fact is that number is out there and already priced into the bond market. So we're seeing a lot of push downward for stocks as people kind of say, right, I'm going to take my money and run and sit on the sidelines for a little while.
Earnings are okay?
For some, right? So this was part of Friday's problem, is Verizon had awful earnings, or at least not so great earnings, right? And that was enough to kind of send people, you know, into a tizzy. And so, you know, we are seeing that some components of the Dow are not coming through, whereas some are doing great, like Coca-Cola's profits beat all kinds of records. And then we get to Twitter. So now we've got Elon Musk, who seems to have put together his financing and is making a move on Twitter. And I think that's just serving to make everybody nervous.
Yeah, it was funny because we talked last week about the poison pill that Twitter's board was going to launch, but that's not going to happen now, huh?
No, I think they're thinking that now he's got real money together and he is putting it on the line and wants to take over the company. And I think what they've probably done is sample where they think the big stockholders are. So Vanguard, which is, you know, the mutual fund index fund company, Vanguard is a big holder of Twitter stock. And I think it's about 10%. They own a little bit more than, well, who knows how much Elon Musk owns now. But when he said he owned 9%, I think they owned a little bit more than that. And certainly they would have consulted with Vanguard and said, what do you think about this? And I think a lot of their investors may say, we're ready to take the money and run. And if that happens, you know, if they've sampled them and the big investors say they would take the money, they're going to be forced to do something.
Well, what would happen to Twitter if Elon Musk ran it? And I'm not saying who's on or off Twitter, how he's going to manage it, but I wonder how much more profitable, how much more successful Twitter would be.
Well, it could be a lot more successful, but since it wouldn't be public anymore, none of us would know. And he wouldn't have to disclose it. You know, he would be the one who's financing it, he and his investors. We don't even know really who those are yet. But everybody who is a current holder of Twitter would get, I think, $54 and some change for each share of stock that they hold.
Yeah, I'm sort of imagining what the stock price would do, but there wouldn't be a stock price then, would there?
There would not. It would absolutely go off the market. And that, you know, is a reasonable response, I suppose. I'm a little bit more concerned about what Elon Musk is going to do with the platform itself and how he's going to allow and who he's going to allow access to it. But it would be a private company, and as far as the Dow is concerned or any of the markets, there wouldn't be an impact.
Well, I think the elephant in the room is would he allow a Donald Trump to come back on? Not a Donald Trump, the Donald Trump. Would he allow the Donald Trump to come back on?
My guess is that he would. And, you know, this is why I think there's some scrambling going on in Washington and other leaders around the world who are trying to figure out a way to impose rules that would require him to not eliminate other voices, but at least control what the trolls do and what people are actually saying. Social media, there's been a lot of news around this, this idea that social media is out of control, that our young people, particularly young women, are suffering psychological damage from, companies like Facebook and Instagram, that the discourse of the world has gotten uglier and, it's more invasive than it was. So there's a lot of concern about what Elon Musk might do. I just have to say, when you look at Elon Musk's track record, it's pretty strong in a lot of different kinds of companies. The guy owns the Boring Company, so drilling holes. He's working on a way to get you from place to place a lot faster with the Hyperloop. He's going to space. He runs an electric motor vehicle company and is building a company that sells electric vehicles and electric producing tiles, solar panel roof tiles. The guy is really a master at a lot of different industries. And so if he thinks he can master the Twitterverse, more power to him.
Elise Glink starts the week off with us. And let's talk a little bit about interest rates. They keep going up, Elise.
They sure do, John. The 30-year mortgage interest rate hit 5.2% at the end of last week. And this morning, it kicked off at 5.3%, almost 5.3%. It was up 4 basis points from a week ago. And when you look at how much home prices have increased over the last year, that plus mortgage interest rates, which are a full double of where they were a year ago, and you realize that it's going to cost you 30 to 40% more to buy a house this year than last year. And that is a big jump for a lot of people.
Yeah, no kidding. So the market, what's happening to the market then? What's going on?
Well, I think this is all, again, part of inflation, right? We've got the bonds being bid up. The 10-year bond is at 3%, could go higher. We've got short-term interest rates that are going up. We actually saw the crossing again of short-term and longer-term interest rates, right, which is the inverted yield curve. That's a little bit of a concern. And, these kinds of rates are the things that drive everything from student loan rates to credit card rates, mortgage rates. So it's going to really cost people a little bit more, if not a lot more money, just depending on where your credit score is. So I guess the bottom line is if you want the best deal that is out there, you're going to have to make sure your credit score is as high as possible.
And 5.2% is probably what you're going to pay for the money now.
Right now, it's around 5 to 5.2%. 5.2% with the average, and then you can buy that down, so you get a little bit lower than that if you want to pay the points up front. A point is 1% of the loan amount. We're also seeing, again, this is an average, so people with lower credit scores will pay higher than that. People with higher credit scores might pay a little bit less than that. You really have to shop around and understand that if you go somewhere and they give you a rate that just seems ridiculously high, don't take it personally. It just doesn't mean they want your business right now. And that could be for a variety of reasons, because their own, they've already filled up with what they can resell on the secondary mortgage market or some other reason. But keep looking around, shopping around, trying to find somebody who's going to give you good service as well as a good interest rate.
But I'm looking at some of the Chicago housing data and sale prices up and days on the market down. I guess that's somewhat dated now, huh?
Well, it is. I mean, the numbers that we saw from RE/MAX are from March, and here we are at the end of April, but it's only gotten stronger. We saw for the Chicago housing data from RE/MAX, closed transactions were down year over year by a little over 10%, but up 40.5% from February into March. March is typically considered to be the highest point. March and April are the highest points of the spring housing market. Spring housing market's the strongest of the housing quarters, you can say. And we saw year-over-year median sales price in the Chicago metro area to be up to about $310,000, up about 5%. That's kind of normal compared to what we're seeing around the other, the rest of the country. It's going to feel bad, though, because the median sales price nationally now is $360,000. Here in Chicago, it's $310,000, and every seller's going, but I want that other number. But so it goes in Chicago.
Well, but year over year is the number that matters more than month to month, because, of course, it's going to trend up as the weather gets warmer. But how are we doing same time a year ago? And you said that the median sales price is up year over year by 5%. So I wonder if next month we're going to say the same thing.
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's a good point. I think when you think about the big national numbers, what a lot of people look at is that over the last year, nationally, home prices zoomed up 16 to 17%. And in Chicago, RE/MAX is reporting that it was about five, a little over 5%. And so 5% is fantastic, but not if inflation is really running at 8%, 8.5%. Then we're running under the rate of inflation in Chicago. And typically, home prices rise at 1% to 2%, sometimes 3% over the rate of inflation. So other numbers that I've seen from Redfin and from others are showing that Chicago housing prices are actually rising a little bit faster than what RE/MAX says. I think what really matters and what everybody should focus on is, if you are selling today, how quickly can you sell? And what concerns me is that for some people, if a property has been on the market longer than a week, they think there's something wrong with it. And that is just an astonishing number, that we have been conditioned in this hot market that if something hasn't sold in a week, there must be something wrong with the property.
That certainly was the case in 2020. And I guess there was some of that in 2021 as well, huh?
Yeah, I think so. I do think that the rising interest rates are going to normalize things. We are going to see things slow down a bit. In fact, Redfin reported just this morning that it is starting to sense that home sellers are lowering prices. The market itself, overall, the whole country is starting to slow down. And you would expect that, because you know what? We haven't seen 5%+ interest rates in almost 12 years.
And, you know, I think that when the rates were creeping up from sub-3 to 3.2, 3.5, and some of us were chuckling, saying, well, you know, it doesn't make that much difference. They can't get much lower. If I told you someday you only pay 3.5% for your money, you would have said thank you. But 5% is different than 3%. That's a noticeable bite, isn't it?
It is. As I said earlier, you know, people are finding that it is a significant jump, and they're seeing that, you know, they're certainly paying more each month for that mortgage. One of the ways you know this is that I just saw that one of the secondary market leaders is coming out with a 40-year streamline refinance. This is a product for people who can't afford their mortgages and they have to sort
really?
Of rejigger the numbers. And I saw that they're going to start approving a 40-year loan. That's how you know that interest rates have gotten really high.
Yeah. Well, you know, listen, whatever it takes to get you in the door, you all manage your money accordingly. But that, to me, is a red flag. If you have to borrow money over the course of 40 years, maybe you shouldn't be buying that house. But, you know, I'll let individuals make those decisions.
Well, the good news, John, is if we do go into recession next year, while causing a whole lot of other problems, we should see at that point interest rates start to come back down. So this could be just a quick bump of maybe a year or so of higher interest rates, and then maybe we'll settle into something a little bit more affordable. Time will tell. I'll keep watching for you.
Elise Glink is the owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves. She's the host of This Week in Wealth with our friend Tom Fortino here on WGN Radio. You can hear her and Tom Sundays at 6:30 a.m. ThinkLink.com is the website. Thank you, Elise.
Thank you, John.
Mondays at this time, we visit with Jim Dahlke, senior editor at Chicago Inno. Let's talk about the Department of Defense investment in the Chicago area. Jim, what's the story here?
Hey, John. Yes. So last week, the Department of Defense officially opened its next innovation center here in Chicago, as it really looks to connect with more tech startups throughout the Midwest. So the DOD's what it calls its Defense Innovation Unit, which is an organization that partners with tech firms to use their products for national defense. So it's taking their commercial products and using it within the DOD. They have a Chicago office now. It joins their headquarters out in Mountain View and additional offices in Boston, Austin, and D.C. So this is the first Midwest office for the organization. And really the whole goal here is to connect with Chicago startups. So they really want to establish a presence here in Chicago and in the Midwest as a reliable source of potential revenue for local startups. You know, I was talking to the Midwest director, and he says that, you know, a lot of startups around here that they've talked to don't really think of the DOD as a potential customer and a revenue stream. And so they're looking to change that.
So are they customers or are they angel investors?
So this is customers. So what the DOD is able to do with their Defense Innovation Unit here is award contracts to companies when using their products out in the field. So, you know, they've worked with all different types of companies, you know, drone companies, satellite companies, all kinds of different tech firms that are creating products that they can use out in the field. So since 2016, this unit has given out over 260 awards across 30 states. And really what this is looking to do is just have a stronger foothold in the Midwest. Of course, there's a lot of tech activity in Chicago and across the region broadly, and they really want to you know, better connect with those companies here.
For a while, everybody had a blog, then everybody had an app, now everybody has a podcast. There is a travel app called Out of Office, which you wrote about. What's the story here?
Yeah, so this company, Out of Office, just raised some money last week. So they raised $3.5 million in new funding. Just launched in 2021, you know, kind of a tricky time to launch a travel app right in the sort of middle of a pandemic. But, you know, really what they have found is that, you know, people like to make travel plans based on recommendations from people they trust. And that's really what Out of Office is all about. So Out of Office has created this trip planning platform that lets you, you know, plan trips based on recommendations from your friends, from your network, from, you know, online influencers that you trust. They have now raised $5 million since they launched just last year. They've got some pretty heavy hitter investors behind them, Chicago's Hyde Park Venture Partners, as well as Stephen Galanis, the CEO, of course, of Cameo. They've got some really interesting growth. They say their users now have made 50,000 recommendations in the app. So this is where you go in and say, hey, I really love this hotel, or I really love this restaurant. And that sort of helps, you know, future users of the app, you know, influence where they want to go. So they really hope to be a one-stop shop for travel. So right now you kind of go into the app to help book and, you know, to plan out and get inspiration for your trip. But eventually they're going to offer travel booking as well. So you can book your hotel, book your flight right through the app.
Is this app up and running? Can I download it now?
Yep. It's on iOS right now. So on your Apple iPhone, you can get the Out of Office app. And they said they've grown users a ton over the last last year here, as more people are getting comfortable getting back out on the road.
Oh, yeah, sure. That's a stupid question. You just said they had like 50,000 people. So, but it's funny then, who are its competition? Because it seems to me like this space is already occupied, you know?
Yes. So, I mean, their competition is very wide, actually. So, really, I mean, they're going up against TripAdvisor, for one. You know, yeah. This is, you know, in Yelp, you know, for recommendations and planning as well. So, they have got some big heavy hitters in the industry. But, you know, they're also going up against Instagram, right? So, people go to Instagram to get travel inspiration and tips. And really, you know, what they see is that on Instagram, you know, those posts, you know, go away or they get buried in a feed and it's hard to surface them. And so, what they're able to do with their platform is make it really easily accessible to see where your friends have gone to travel and where they like, rather than having to search deep, deep, deep through someone's Instagram feed.
Talk to us about Just Eat Takeaway.
Yeah, so this is the Netherlands food company that acquired Grubhub just 1 year ago in a massive $7.3 billion deal. And now, 1 year later, after that acquisition was official, the company says it may sell Grubhub. So that was a note that they made in an investor update just last week. It said that they are actively exploring the possibility of a full or a partial sale of Grubhub. The announcement comes as the company has been under pressure from activist investors for its financial performance. The Just Eat Takeaway's stock has been down about 50% year to date and almost 70% in the last 12 months. And so really just the latest turn in the Grubhub saga. Of course, 4 months after the deal was official, their CEO and co-founder Matt Maloney stepped down from the company. Not unusual after a big acquisition, but their founder is now no longer with the company. And we're going to see who may step up to the plate here to purchase Grubhub.
And one last story today, anyway, to talk about it. It's the business of logistics. What's the Chicago connection here?
Yeah, so a new report came out really kind of detailing the growth of the logistics tech industry in Chicago. Obviously, Chicago is a major, major logistics player nationally and across the world, but the tech industry within logistics, basically made up of software and hardware companies that support the industry, really growing in Chicago. So funding for logistics tech startups in the city increased more than 800% from 2019 to 2021. There's over 100 logistics tech firms in Chicago and 34,000 employees here working in the logistics tech industry. That's third highest in the country behind New York and San Francisco. So local leaders here really bullish on the logistics tech space here in Chicago.
Jim Dahlke, senior editor at ChicagoInno.com. Thank you, Jim. We'll talk next week.
Thanks, Sean.
Let's update you now on the Wintrust Business Lunch with more business news and Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Mondelez International has reached an agreement with Grupo Bimbo to acquire Mexican confectionery business Ricolini for $1.3 billion. Mondelez says the deal will accelerate its snacking business in Mexico, which it calls a high-priority market. Ricolino brands include the namesake Vero and La Corona. Mondelez is the maker of snack products like Oreo cookies. The deal expected to close late in the third quarter or early in the fourth quarter of this year. The CEO of Chicago Community Trust is stepping down. Cranes reports Dr. Helene Gale has accepted the president's job at Spelman College in Atlanta. Spelman is one of the country's historically black colleges, a liberal arts school for women. Gale will leave the Chicago Community Trust in June. The Trust's executive committee will start a search for her successor. Gale was the first woman and the second person of color to hold the CEO post at the Chicago Community Trust. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Steve Alexander is away today, but we've still got the business of food and Lindsay Tobin.
Farmers are facing record high input costs. Spring anhydrous is up a whopping 298% year over year. Phosphorus up 191%, potash 214%, and Roundup 273%, just to name a few. We spoke with Virgil Schmidt from the Iowa State Extension Office to see what steps can be taken to lower these costs.
Be really critical about, do I need this input or not? For phosphorus and potassium, if the soils are testing low or very low, I don't care what the price of the fertilizer is this year, we need to put it on. If the soils are testing high or very high, the likelihood we're going to get our money back is very minimal.
Russia is the world's second largest exporter of oil and gas. The invasion will most certainly affect our fuel and food prices. Natural gas is a key ingredient in nitrogen-based fertilizers. Virgil explains how utilizing the nitrogen rate calculator is vital to using less.
Take a look at the price of the nitrogen, what you think you can get back from your crop, and then with that, looking at how the crops respond in those areas to nitrogen fertilizers, can say, this is a sweet spot. This is where you're going to get your maximum return on investment.
Most industries pass on their additional costs to the consumers. Although farmers don't have this ability, there is still opportunity with the current and future prices of commodities. Ryan Girolet from the Iowa State Extension Office explains how to find these opportunities in a volatile market.
Making sure that we understand what our break-even prices are and doing an excellent job on our marketing plans, making sure that we have a marketing plan in place. Bottom line is I need to make sure I have my cost of production numbers in hand as I start out my marketing year and I start pre-harvest marketing and looking at opportunities to lock in a profit. So there are still opportunities even with the higher prices and fertilizer and all of my inputs.
With the business of food, I'm Lindsay Tobin for WGN.
Amy Guth joins us Mondays at this time each week to update us on As the Musk Turns. So what's the latest?
Yeah, well, you know, so last week we were talking about how Elon Musk had said he had gathered the financing to buy Twitter. And so many outlets, including the New York Times, is reporting this morning that Twitter is nearing a deal to sell itself to Elon Musk. And so that would take the platform private if that deal should happen. So, according to reporting, Twitter's board was negotiating with him into the early hours and over this unsolicited bid. So that was we shall see. All the reporting on it indicates that we might get an answer. We might have news on this as early as later today. So carefully watching that to see what would happen, what that would look like for Twitter if this deal goes through, if Elon Musk purchases it.
Is he tipping his hand at all? Do we know what he's going to do with it? What, how would I notice a difference? Everybody speculated he's an absolutist, et cetera. But I wonder what we would notice differently.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing is he's been talking about the edit button. That's kind of the big thing he pushed on. But, you know, I'm curious, too, because he for a very long time was almost trolling Twitter, on the platform, talking about, you know, if I owned it, I would do this differently, and accusing the platform of not even taking free speech very seriously. So I think a lot of questions are swirling around what would that look like? What would that mean? Would that mean certain banned accounts are no longer banned? What would that look like? And what does that mean for users?
Speaking of regulating speech, the EU has a law targeting big tech. What's the story here?
So the EU has kind of been a leader in this space of really putting social media giants, these big tech platforms, on notice and putting some of the harshest regulations against them. And that's in big contrast to here in the US, mostly lobbyists that represent Silicon Valley interests are pretty successful at keeping federal lawmakers away from the platforms for the most part. That said, the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission have filed some lawsuits against Google and Facebook, and Congress has pretty divided on efforts to address the competition. But we've seen some of the, you know, big tech leaders come in and testify to Congress. But the EU essentially now, with the approval of this, it happened early Saturday. So now big tech companies have to take further steps to protect European users from hate speech, from disinformation access, and other kind of harmful online content. And this is part of the Digital Services Act. So this is a big overhaul of the entire EU bloc's digital rule book. So they've done steps like this before, but this is really pretty significant, where they've kind of moved the ball down the field and really, really putting very, very tight structures on these big tech companies.
We're talking 27 countries, 45 yeah. million users. Huh? Wow.
Sure. Yeah, it's a very big swath of people. And you know, as I've been reading about it, as different people, different tech reporters have been reporting on it, and even some of the blog posts from the companies themselves have been talking about it, and certainly European tech reporters talking about this, of kind of what that means. It's really about exposure to dangerous content. And it's not even a matter of labeling disinformation or misinformation, but actively going against it, saying even exposure to it is harmful. Also regulating and helping people mm-hmm. to better surface problematic content, keep advertising away from children that might be harmful to them. There's a lot to it.
This is the EU. So I wonder then if the yeah. functionality of my experience with Facebook or Twitter or Google in Europe would be different than it is in the United States. Would the platform look different?
I don't know that it would look different, but the kind of content you would be getting if you took your laptop and went to the EU and started using it, the type of content you would be getting by using a European IP address to access it would certainly look different. As it is, we see a little bit of this. If we're going to a European site, often we'll see a pretty detailed cookie notification that might look a little bit more thorough than what we have on a lot of websites here in the US. We already see that about tracking data and kind of that right to be forgotten, which is a big movement in Europe. And also with news organizations. So especially in France, there's been a lot of movement to really take into account how Google parses that sort of information, how people access information, and is it quality reporting, or is it, you know, a random person with a blog with really good SEO? So a lot of conversations have been happening in EU courtrooms for a number of years, and they've really been kind of out ahead of this and really approached it very differently than we have in the US.
Well, I'll say SpaceX splashdown. What's the latest there?
At long last. So they were supposed to be here about a week ago, and then it got delayed. I think last time we talked, they were going to be delayed until a little bit later, but it finally happened today. So this is the first all-private crew, as you may recall. They went to the International Space Station. They were going to be there about 10 days, but it ended up going a week longer. But they have just in about the last hour and a half have splashed down off the coast of Florida. And so the next step is they're pulled onto a special boat. It's called the Dragon's Nest, pulled onto this boat to check safety issues on the capsule and get the astronauts out.
They were up there 7 more days than they thought they were going to be up there?
Yeah, what an interesting bonus, right? So they had pretty busy days planned for the time they were going to be there. They were doing some work projects, and they were also doing a lot of planned outreach. The number I read was that they were doing about 14 hours of work a day while they were there. But that last week, not so much. You know, they didn't really have their schedules on lock as much. And so the comment was that they had a little extra time to kind of look at the earth and look at space and just kind of appreciate the moment they were in and the opportunity they had. A lot of questions still on the price tag for that. So it had been reported earlier that that was about a $55 million price tag. So we shall see. Like, I'm not sure really exactly what that was. Everybody associated with that mission has declined to say the exact number there, but Axiom had previously disclosed that price. So unclear what the price tag was, but they certainly got a bonus for their whatever they paid to be there.
Maybe it was speculative, but I did see some sort of breakdowns of what the cost would be for food, for staff to support them, et cetera. It's sort of like when you get off a cruise ship and you find out your coat costs $9, you know, and the numbers were astronomical, no pun intended. But I suppose at this point in space tourism or space travel, you would expect that. We will talk more this week. Thank you, Amy Guth.
Sounds good.